From South Dakota to New Jersey, Louisiana to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, a recent ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court invalidating certain tariffs has one small business taking legal action in an effort to secure a refund. Kathy Hoekstra from the Pacific Legal Foundation has details. Texas kicked off the primary election season, resulting in some upsets and setting up a U.S. Senate seat runoff. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. When does military action meet the legal definition of becoming a war? Eric Boehm and Matthew Petty of Reason Magazine are here to explore. And presidential war powers are once again in the spotlight as the U.S. and Israel take military action against Iran. Former Congressman Keith Rothfuss has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. A small business that paid tens of thousands of dollars in tariffs, now ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court, is seeking a refund. Kathy Hoekstra from the Pacific Legal Foundation shines the American hero spotlight on the case. Kathy?
Well, you've no doubt heard by now about the blockbuster Supreme Court decision that, contrary to the president's claim, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, passed by Congress in 1977, does not authorize the president to impose tariffs. Broadly speaking, this 6-3 ruling is a huge win for the separation of powers in the Constitution and the American people. But for small businesses across the country, the people that they serve and the livelihoods they support, this ruling is personal. It is a lifeline. Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Hoekstra with Pacific Legal Foundation, and this is American Radio Journal. Joining me today is Eva St. Clair, along with Rebecca Melski, children's clothing entrepreneurs and American heroes whose valiant fight to save Princess Awesome from the president's tariffs has advanced to the next chapter after this very powerful Supreme Court ruling. Eva and Rebecca, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us. We're so happy to be here.
Oh, we're happy to have you. Well, Princess Awesome and Boy Wonder is, of course, the name of the business that the two of you co-founded back in 2012 to smash stereotypes. What does this mean when it comes to kids' clothing? And have you had smashing success since you launched the business more than a decade ago now?
Yes, our business has been a smashing success. It turns out there are thousands and thousands of people who have children or who are children at heart and love dinosaurs, trucks, trains, dragons of all kinds on their clothing, that they want to just wear the things that they love and that identify their interests to other people. And we have a wonderful customer base, very loyal returning customer base who love what we do. And we are just delighted that every day we wake up and make clothes that reflect the things that they love.
Well, starting a business is daunting in and of itself, but the two of you dove right into what the New York Times called a crash course in the challenges of American manufacturing. What were those earlier challenges and how did you navigate them?
So when we first started and we were manufacturing exclusively in the United States, we had a really hard time finding all of the different pieces of production. So we had to find a place where we could print the types of prints that we wanted to have on the types of fabrics that we wanted, cotton, knits, like comfortable fabrics for kids' clothing. Then we had to find a factory that would cut and sew to, you know, that would be reasonably priced and could do smaller minimums. Then we had to find elastic, we had to find labels, we had to find pattern makers and someone who could grade it. We had to do each one of those individual pieces separately. And then for every new product that we wanted to make, we had to start the process all over again. And it's in the American supply chain for clothing is very challenging to work with.
You tried really hard to keep everything in America, but that was really costly. So then you discovered China. You developed some really good partnerships with some really good manufacturing folks there. And then President Trump's first administration imposed tariffs on China. So you went abroad to some other countries as well. Before we get into the 2025 tariffs, talk about where you went after China.
So we realized after the 2017 tariffs that it just made sense to have a diversified supply chain. And by the time the pandemic hit, that became so stunningly obvious that we were just actually grateful that we had diversified into different countries, because countries shut down throughout the pandemic at different times and throughout the year, throughout the 2 or 3 years of the pandemic. So we had things that were in production in some countries that didn't come in on time, but other places started opening up. So it really helped a lot to diversify. So over the last 10 years, we've manufactured in China, Bangladesh, India, Peru, Colombia, and Pakistan. Oh, and Vietnam too. So it's been an education learning how global supply chains work.
And then comes 2025, early in the year, the president imposes a bunch of tariffs on all kinds of countries. Explain how much of a blow this round of tariffs had been for you, not just financially, but the uncertainty caused by the tariffs constantly moving parts.
I mean, it's been impossible. We have had so many production meetings where we've said, okay, well, we thought we were going to make these here, but now the tariffs just went up, so we need to move it to this other country. But what if tariffs go up there? And then, I mean, it's just been impossible. We don't know, or we haven't known, how much our products were going to cost when they come to shore. Like, that is not a way to run a business where you don't know how much your products are going to cost. It's insane. And it's impossible to plan. And it's impossible to make the best, most cost-efficient products for our customers. And it has been it's caused a lot of gray hairs.
And you have had to pay some of the tariffs, right?
Oh, yeah. We paid a lot. Yeah.
In 2025, we paid $30,000 in additional tariffs, right? We expect to pay customs fees. We budget that into our plans, but it was $30,000 in additional tariffs. And looking ahead to this year, had this ruling not happened, we were looking at over $100,000 in additional tariffs.
Let's talk about this decision now. The federal lawsuit you and 10 other businesses filed with free representation from PLF. Yours was among many similar cases. The Supreme Court picked a different one, but you did. Their case was fortified by the amicus support that you filed. And since we're recording this just 3 days after the Supreme Court's ruling, everybody wants to know, what did you think when you learned about the decision? Hooray!
It was incredible news, and it was so vindicating that Chief Justice Roberts used our exact arguments in his brief to read the things that we had written put into the decision. Was amazing. Amazing. Like, to know that they agreed with us that Congress is supposed to have the power to tax. This is a major questions doctrine issue, and it is not right for the president to assume that he can take Congress's power just because it's written into a tiny little piece of one law that was not meant to be used in that particular way.
Eva St. Clair, Rebecca Malsky, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and congratulations.
Thank you,
Kathy. And thank you especially to PLF for being the best lawyers in the country.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, we do our best. And you can learn more about Princess Awesome Case and all the work we're doing at Pacific Legal Foundation at pacificlegal.org. I'll be back next month with another courageous American hero. I'm Kathy Hoekstra for American Radio Journal.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. The primary election season has kicked off in Texas, North Carolina, some other states. We're going to focus on Texas today. Some very interesting races. Scott Parkinson has the details. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Of course, we have a U.S. Senate seat up, John Cornyn, the incumbent in Texas, a very important race for the balance of power in Washington, D.C. So, Scott, give us a rundown on what happened in the primary in that U.S. Senate race. Interesting on both sides of the aisle.
I think I would start out with the Republican side, just because you've got an incumbent, longtime U.S. Senator, John Cornyn, who's vulnerable because he's taken some votes against President Trump over the past 10 years or so and created a little bit of space for the MAGA lane. What she had there was two challengers. One of them was a U.S. representative from the Houston area named Wesley Hunt. He ended up coming in third place, and his campaign is over. However, Ken Paxton finished about 2% behind John Cornyn in the primary this Tuesday. And so what we're going to see is a runoff election in May to determine who the Republican nominee is. And Ken Paxton, John Cornyn, they've already spent $70 million plus through various entities and super PACs supporting John Cornyn's reelection campaign. And President Trump put out a Truth Social this week, and he said, listen, this has cost a lot of money already. I'm going to make an endorsement of one of these candidates in the near future. And when I do, I'm going to call out the other one to drop out. And so that's kind of the big story in Washington, D.C. Is he going to come out and support the incumbent, John Cornyn? Is he going to support Ken Paxton, the former attorney general of Texas? Or maybe he actually changes his mind and doesn't weigh in. I think there's all eyes there to see what he does. Then on the Democrat side, you had Jasmine Crockett running against Representative Tallarico, and Crockett lost. There was a lot of people, the AOC, the sort of justice warriors that the left has. They were hoping that Jasmine Crockett would be the nominee. But Tallarico tried to run a moderate campaign with sort of like the rhetoric that I think made Beto O'Rourke pretty popular in Texas a couple of cycles ago. However, we need to unpack all this opposition research on Tallarico because he's anything but a moderate. He is just as liberal as Jasmine Crockett. Here's somebody that, you know, has talked about white racism and Black Lives Matter, and he's talked about Anthony Fauci and posting pictures of Fauci as action figure. And he's also, you know, just had all these crazy statements saying that Jesus Christ was non-binary. I mean, these people, you can't even replicate somebody like Tampon Tim Walz in Minnesota running in Texas without Tallarico. So maybe it's Tampon Tallarico eventually, but that is not what's representative of the Lone Star State. I am incredibly confident that whoever the Republican nominee is, whether it's Ken Paxton or John Cornyn, we're going to hold that seat in November.
We, of course, will keep a close eye on that. Republicans, of course, need to hold Texas in order to hold on to their majority in the U.S. Senate. And we also, around Texas, had some very, very interesting competitive primary races for seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. Want to fill us in on some of those highlights?
Club for Growth PAC made several endorsements. And first one I'd kind of point to is former Major League Baseball All-Star and World Series champion Mark Teixeira won the Republican nomination in the 21st District of Texas to replace retiring Representative Chip Roy, who's running for Attorney General. And Teixeira won that with over 50% of the vote. He will not face a runoff. And another big one in the 10th District to replace Michael McCaul, Club for Growth PAC endorsed Chris Gober, who is a longtime Texas attorney, helped out Elon Musk in the 2024 elections, being his super PAC's attorney. Chris is a brilliant legal mind, Harvard educated, went to Texas A&M, and he won his race in the 10th without a runoff. There's a couple of other kind of interesting races that are still maturing. In Texas 38, which is that Wesley Hunt district that's open, Jonathan Bonk finished just below 50%, so he is going to go to a runoff. And then in the 9th district, Alex Mueller will be facing Briscoe Kane. The Club PAC has also endorsed Alex Mueller in that race. We think that she's got what it takes to be a tough, smart, and effective member of the House of Representatives that won't bend her knee to the leadership. So, listen, I think that there's a lot of sort of new blood coming in that Texas delegation, and that's a good thing, right? We want to make sure that in the House of Representatives you have turnover that doesn't get too close to the political oligarchy and is representative, I say that word intentionally, is representative of the community upon which they serve. And we're really, really excited about those candidates and those campaigns. Obviously, there was a bunch of races where the club did not make endorsements that are ongoing. And one, I think you've got a U.S. Representative, Tony Gonzalez, who has gotten himself in a ton of trouble. This week, he admitted to an extramarital affair with one of his staffers in the district, and she ended up committing suicide by lighting herself on fire. And Congressman Gonzalez owned up to the fact that they had an affair this week. He's running against YouTube Second Amendment star named Brandon Herrera. Herrera barely lost to Gonzalez in the 2024 election cycle, and this time he has the advantage of actually receiving more votes than Gonzalez. in that primary. This is the 23rd district along the border. That's going to be a big, big race.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, a few words about the club.
Well, today we talked about politics, and Club for Growth has a membership pack. If you want to learn more about the candidates that we've endorsed in the 2026 election cycle, you can visit us at clubforgrowth.org and learn more about those candidates. You can also sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Practically speaking, the U.S. military action in Iran is a war, but legally the definition might be a little bit different. Eric Boehm and Matthew Petty of Reason Magazine are here to parse through the distinction.
We're now several days into America's war with Iran, and yes, I think war is the appropriate term to use for this, regardless of what the president and members of Congress might think. Legally, may not be a war. Certainly, militarily, it looks like one. At this point, several days in, we still don't have a whole lot of clarity about the objectives here, what the timeline might be. We're going to try to get some of that clarity with my guest today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest is Matthew Petty. He's an assistant editor for us at Reason Magazine, a colleague of mine. He joins us here, I think, for the first time on the program. He covers the Middle East, covers foreign policy for us at Reason, and has been following, obviously, the ongoing situation there since Saturday when the bombing began. Matthew, thanks for taking some time and being here today.
Thanks for having me on.
Right off the bat, I guess I should say that we are recording this on Wednesday evening, and so by the time anybody out there hears it, circumstances may have changed because war is chaotic. And hey, there it is again. I called this a war, Matthew. That's a good place to start. Are we at war?
Yes, we are at war with Iran. I mean, this is a large-scale military attack. Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War, describes it as a war. There are missiles flying back and forth. People are getting killed. I mean, it's a little bit ridiculous not to call this a war. And I mean, right, the reason is that, first of all, legally, the president, you know, in theory, Congress is supposed to declare war. The president's not supposed to do that just unilaterally. And we have something called the War Powers Act, which is now being activated. So, you know, there's a legal reason they're denying it's a war. But I think also they're sort of trying to tell the public and particularly the markets, like, oh, no, this is going to be over really soon. This is no big deal. When it is, I mean, at the same time they're saying that, General Kane is going out and saying that we dropped twice as much ordnance as we did during the Iraq War. And so they're sort of plainly denying reality. We're at war. There are things being fired back and forth between two major countries. Two large armies, lots of different places are getting bombed. American troops have been killed. Iranian troops have been killed. I mean, if this isn't war, then what is war?
We've had some mixed signals from the administration so far about this, not just whether it's a war or not, but how long it might go on for. Do we have any firm sense of what the timeline here could be? A matter of days, matter of weeks, or is it more of an ongoing thing?
I mean, the thing about war is the enemy gets a vote. And I think actually, I think this is one thing where the Trump administration sort of flip-flopping or weird goalposts moving in public is not necessarily so unreasonable because, you know, this changes with conditions on the ground. It's very hard to say. I mean, this thing is not wrapping up quickly. And I mean, I might be terribly wrong. There might be a ceasefire tomorrow. But from where I'm looking now on Wednesday, this thing does not look like it's wrapping up quickly. It's spread across multiple different countries.
Yeah, I think we would all be pretty grateful if this whole segment ends up being obsolete by Friday because there's a ceasefire. It doesn't look like that's the case. I want to also ask you about what happens if we go the other direction. Boots on the ground is kind of the phrase that gets tossed around for actually putting, obviously there are American troops in harm's way. At least six of them have been killed already in this conflict, but there's the potential certainly that there could be many more.
This is what they really mean when they say this is not going to be the Iraq War. They mean that it's not going to put Americans in as direct harm's way. We're not going to have American armies going into Iran on the ground and occupying it. But of course, that's very easy to say at the very beginning of this kind of thing. And we're already seeing signs that, well, the goalposts might be moving. I don't know if you've seen the reporting, but there's this idea now that there's going to be, that the CIA is going to arm a Kurdish rebellion and sort of force an uprising because the Iranian people haven't risen up, I guess, on the timeline that Trump wanted them to. They're going to try to arm a proxy army of Kurds inside Iran through the Iraqi border. I very much believe that this will eventually end up with American special forces getting involved. And I strongly suspect that is the reason why members of Congress have come out of these briefings saying there might be boots on the ground, why officials in the administration have been so reluctant to rule that out.
We are talking with Matthew Petty. He is an assistant editor for Reason Magazine. He's a colleague of mine, and we're talking about the ongoing conflict between the United States and Iran in the Middle East. Matt, not a lot of time left here, but before I let you go, I just wanted to ask about, because I know this is something you've written about before for us, about just the sheer amount of weaponry that we've used already here just in the first week of this conflict. This is something where we don't necessarily, we like to think that our military is more or less limitless, but we have a finite supply of bombs and missiles and things, and every one that we use in Iran is one that we won't have to use potentially against another more serious foe.
There's a lot of talk today about interceptor shortages, I mean, because we use very expensive munitions to shoot down these Iranian missiles. We've already burned through a huge stock of them. We're going to continue burning through them. Even if it doesn't help Iran, it leaves the U.S. very unprepared because, as I wrote a couple of years ago in Reason, when you look at the dollar sign on ammunition, it's not just a matter of like balancing your accounts and moving money from one thing to another. These are physical resources with very specific bottlenecks. You need lots of like precision machined components and electronics to build these interceptor missiles. And we're burning through, I'm not talking about months, I'm talking about years of production in a single day. I'm pretty sure that China, even if they're not going to come to Iran's aid, is very happy to see this happening.
Yeah, many, many concerns here, and obviously a lot of moving pieces, a lot of things that we don't understand, a lot of unknown unknowns, as Donald Rumsfeld might have once put it, but we appreciate you walking through some of what we do know and what might come next. Matt, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you. I hope I'm too pessimistic. I hope everything turns out for the better, but it seems like a pretty dire situation.
As always in war, we are hoping for the best and expecting the worst or preparing for the worst. That is Matt Petty from Reason Magazine. You can check out more of his fine coverage of everything going on with the war in Iran this week at Reason.com. I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Congress has failed to clearly define a president's war powers. So once again, the issue has arisen as the United States launches military action against Iran. Keith Rothfuss examines the situation on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The news last Saturday morning that President Trump had launched a regime change war against Iran brought to mind the 2013 commencement address I gave at my son's high school graduation during my first year in Congress. I told the graduates that theirs was the first class in United States history who have had their country at war during the entirety of their schooling, from first grade through 12th grade. I suggested that, to them, it may seem normal to be in a state of constant war. I told them it was not. Although the wars I had in mind in that 2013 speech eventually ended, skirmishes and other hotspots involving U.S. forces continued. Strikes against al-Qaeda affiliates in Africa, actions against Iranian-backed rebels in Yemen, the crushing of ISIS, retribution against Syria for Assad's use of chemical weapons, and the elimination of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps leader, Qassem Soleimani, who was responsible for the death and maiming of thousands of American soldiers in Iraq. Some of these actions were arguably within the scope of prior congressional authorizations to use military force, others not so much. Operation Epic Fury, the new war with Iran, was launched without any congressional approval. Why does and should congressional authorization matter? It matters because our Constitution divides responsibility for war between the executive and legislative branches. The president is commander-in-chief and has an inherent authority to conduct foreign affairs and direct the armed forces. Congress, however, holds the power to declare war, raise and support armies, maintain a navy, regulate the armed forces, and control the purse. Supporters of Trump's actions cite historical examples to support what President Trump is doing. But such prior actions pale in comparison to what is underway now. Major combat operations, Trump's words, to eliminate Iran's threats and to change the government of a nation with more than 90 million people. There is simply no precedent for such an action being taken without prior congressional approval. The closest analogies may be the first President Bush's deposing of Panamanian President Noriega and President Obama's NATO air campaign in Libya. But congressional acquiescence to two prior presidents does not give this, or any president, carte blanche to take us into war. The Libya and Panama actions were far more limited than what is underway in Iran, where day one of the war saw the elimination by airstrike of dozens of Iran's leaders, including its supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. While there may be concerns over the constitutional basis for Operation Epic Fury, the evil that Iran has done over 47 years of destabilizing the Middle East and maiming, killing, and tormenting Americans cannot be overstated. A listing of places and names suffices as a reminder. Beirut Embassy bombing, Beirut Marine Barracks bombing, Beirut Embassy Annex bombing, TWA 847 hijacking and killing of Navy diver Robert Steatham, Beirut kidnappings and the murder of CIA Station Chief William Francis Buckley, Khobar Towers, USS Cole, IEDs used against Americans in the Iraq War, all constituted acts of war against the United States, but the U.S. never truly responded in kind until last Saturday. Given all that Iran has done and threatened to do, should the American people, through their elected representatives in Congress, have had a say in the decision to go to war? The Constitution's grant of war-making power to Congress is not a dead letter. But like so many things over the last 80 years, Congress has acceded to the executive branch's ever-expanding power. It is too bad our representatives did not debate this war before it began. They could have probed intelligence findings and perhaps learned that they were more reliable than what we were told before the Iraq War. They could have reminded us of the terrible price when intelligence is wrong. They could have pressed for secondary sanctions as an alternative to war. Why, by the way, were we still trading with China when they kept buying Iranian oil? One other benefit of debating before shooting is the chance to consider all potential outcomes of a war. In the run-up to the 2003 Iraq War, one voice on the global stage was standing athwart history yelling, "Stop." That was John Paul II, who called war an adventure of no return. Once it starts, no one knows how it will end. And that is where we find ourselves today. So now, more than ever, Americans should join with the prayer from the Navy hymn. Eternal Father, strong to save, whose arm hath bound the restless wave, hear us when we cry to thee. This is Keith Rothfuss for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WQSU-FM in Selins Grove, Pennsylvania, along with WBBC-FM and WKLV-AM and FM in Blackstone, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.